Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show.
And welcome to the 242nd edition of Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. And today's edition, Santa Claus rally and what's going on with the Trump rally. Money Matters is about money. As money does matter, it matters. Money affects us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. Controls our economy, our country, our planet, in some way or another. Controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. And remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and the opinions of any authors of articles I may read. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. How is everybody today? Glad to be on the air again. Wishing everybody had a good Thanksgiving. And looking forward to a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and a Happy New Year that is coming. So there we go. And we always started out the show, at least in the last couple of months, telling you where the Dow is. We've talked about the major support and resistant levels, the large numbers of the Dow, 16,000, 17,000, 18,000, 19,000. And I believe this is the first show where I can say the Dow is now over 19,000, sitting at 19,184 as I speak, which is Thursday, December 1st, 2016, in the year of our Lord at 12:11:45 p.m. You may hear the show at a different time, of course, so the indices may be different at the time when you hear the show. But those listening live, of course, 19,188.95. I'm looking at an active dynamic screen, so the Dow is moving as I speak. And we have made it over 19,000. We actually closed the week over 19,000 and closed the month over 19,000. So those technical folks that are out there say that that may be a significant milestone. Of course, nobody knows where the market's going to go. But it is indeed an interesting sign. We broke over 19,000. And it's very interesting because what did we expect with the Trump election? The world was going to come apart. Indeed, night of the election, the Dow was down negative 800, 900 points, and the gold was up $60, yet the market opened up next day up and hasn't really stopped to look back. 19,188, where's it going, you know? Interesting things that happened during the Trump election when he was elected, presidential elect, I guess they call him. Saw some sectors run, technology sectors ran, and the infrastructure tech sectors ran. We saw technology get rather slammed. I guess Silicon Valley and Trump were at odds with each other, at least from what I read on some of the websites. Technology did get hammered quite a bit, and now it seems to at least have stabilized there. Fixed income, the holdings of widows and orphans, those are the things like bond funds and utilities and mortgage-backed securities and treasuries and all sorts of other fixed income, which traditionally regarded as conservative holdings versus regular stocks. Fixed income got hit pretty hard, continues to be soft. And so people that thought they were in rather conservative portfolios may have seen their balances drop unexpectedly and more than they might have expected. I'm sure some advisors are rather surprised at that as well. And so interesting thing about fixed incomes, the way they work, without getting too detailed today, if a fixed income price goes down, then the yield it pays will generally go up. And so what happens when fixed income drops, the yields go up, so it may attract more buyers as they see higher yields. So you may not buy a treasury at 1%, but treasury may drop in value and it may yield 1.25% or 2% or whatever, and then it might attract buyers. So there might be a teeter-totter effect, an offsetting effect. The lower prices go, the more people might buy it. And of course, that follows economic 101 theory, right? Drop your price on something and more buyers come forward, raise the price, and less buyers come forward, and less buyers can afford to buy the particular item that you are selling. So it was interesting. Gold's been rather soft, did fall some off, I don't know, 80, 90 bucks in the last 30 days, and so we'll see what happens with that. NASDAQ sits at 5,249, S&P 2190. What does that mean? These are just different indexes. That's all. There's the Dow, 30 stocks in there. And the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 and there's a Russell 2000 or whatever they call it. I don't know. Emerging market funds and all sorts of different things. But has been an interesting what a lot of the news media has named rotation, asset rotation. Sell one thing and buy another. Sell utilities and buy technology or sell technology and buy utilities. Rotation. Saw quite a bit of rotation, and still, I think the market is digesting what the heck's going to happen. And you know, it pays attention to what Trump says he's going to do and who he appoints. So, it is a crapshoot, right? You know what they say. And we do have the Federal Reserve meeting coming up in December, and that could be another market mover. Whether they raise interest rates or not, I think the majority of analysts are expecting a slight increase, maybe a quarter percent and more, and we don't know whether the market will have a knee-jerk reaction to that sell-off, and then it's off to the races or not. We just don't know. And, of course, Santa Claus rally is, some may perceive that historically stocks rally in January or Christmas as big hedge funds and mutual fund advisors and managers rotate out of things they don't want to be in for the year-end report and rotate into other things. So we'll see if the Santa Claus rally will materialize to that effect. And so, my name's Mark. Thanks for joining me today. And we had talked, a lot about pensions, public and pensions. And I'm going to go over that a little bit because I just saw that another large state is in trouble in their pension funds. There's a massive underfunding of pensions. And I published an article on underfunding of a pension in a local newspaper. And I got a response from a reader there that said that their husband's pension had been cut in half, or was planning to be cut in half. So your pension plans, you know, they might be like CalSTRS or UC Berkeley pensions or a university pension, could be private or public or whatever have you. You know, they'll pay you until they don't, or they'll pay you until they reduce the payments. And so, you know, it is interesting. And I don't mean to shock anybody or worry anybody, but pensions and public and large corporation pension plans are widespread, indeed vast in numbers, and they hold trillions of dollars. And they're the lifeblood of many Americans. How many Americans do you know that have a pension? Whether it's not their own or their companies, the governments, or whatever. Public plans, of course, include coverage for federal employees, state and city employees, some public teacher organizations, large universities may be public, or they may, of course, also have private pensions. Private company plans are private companies, of course. They cover a heck of a lot of workers as well. The list is endless and varied, and it's estimated over 20 million people depend on or will depend on these big pensions providing income through their golden years. But a disturbing report out from Moody's Credit Agency gives us some eye-popping estimates as to what is promised versus what these plans actually have on their balance sheets. In other words, like so many other balance sheet problems that we see these days, the shortfalls in pensions are becoming ominous. The problem is you know, multifold. The problem lies in the zero to near zero interest rate environment that exists in our monetary world. Of course, the near zero interest rate environment is, help partially set by the Federal Reserve. And they've pegged their target rate close to zero. For about 7 years now, they've had one increase, so December passed, quarter of a point, and then that may have caused the January rout we saw. It has been really an interesting year for investors, not an easy one for sure. When the Fed does raise interest rates, When they keep them at zero fixed income and investments like bonds and other debt instruments don't pay a lot, or they don't pay as nearly as they used to when they had to compete with the rates, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago when they were 6, 7%. And the reason some of these fixed incomes do not pay a lot because they have to compete with the Federal Reserve rate. Due to their perceived relative safety, however, pension managers and those that handle these large funds lean toward fixed income products to stack the portfolios as they're considered more conservative. So when interest rates drop, so does the yield on these big pension portfolios. The problem is further enhanced by the way pensions figure what they will earn versus the amount of money they are required to keep on hand and how they balance their proverbial books. Based on historical interest rates being much higher, and usually they have been much higher, just look at them, what they've been since the 1900s, the models that these pension plans have used have really gotten ahead of themselves. Assuming the Fed's rates of near zero were going to be temporary emergency measures, that's what they're called, these zero interest rate measures or policies are called emergency rates by the Federal Reserve themselves. And they dropped these rates to address the banking and real estate crisis. The key word here being, by their own admission, temporary. Being temporary, many pension managers assume they were temporary, and they have not revised their assumed income rates. A pension manager just doesn't look at what he got. There are actuarials in the pension management team that looks at what happened, but pension managers may assume a certain rate that they're going to get in the following years. A lot of them have failed to drop their income assumption based on the fact that these were temporary measures, but now they've been going on for 7 years. So this assumption that rates were going to return has kind of hurt them because they've assumed, some of them have assumed return rates of north of 7%. And that can be the crux of the problem. When you assume 7% and you're getting 1%, because a lot of these pensions hold these fixed income products, many things happen. And I wrote an example. You know, suppose your local township knows that a certain amount, an X amount of employees will retire in an X amount of years needing X amount of money. And it doesn't matter what number you use. We just figure this many employees are going to retire. They're going to retire in this amount of years, and they're going to need this amount of money. If you assume a 7% return compounded, the money that the township puts aside will double in 7 years. 7% money doubles in 7 years. Now, let's assume the rates are at 1%, which is maybe what they're getting. The money our township sets aside will now take about 72 years to double. In just 10 years' time, the city's pension plan will be underfunded by about 45%, almost half. If you allow more time to pass and interest rates stay at zero and they assume 7%, the losses grow exponentially. It adds up quick under the laws of compounding. Now that interest rates have remained at zero for so long, and a lot of pension managers have still assumed this 5, 6, 7% return, if they readjust their assumptions now, 6 or 7 years later, after only getting 1%, but assuming 7, the amount of cash they will have to commit to meet these regulations to bring up the amount they have to hold in cash would stress balance sheets to no end. Where would they get the money to bring it up? You know, if you assume 7% for 5 years and it's really been 1, and all of a sudden you readjust it to 7, you might have to put in $1 billion or what have you. This is not to mention the actual shortage they will have in the funds to pay off retirees now and in the future. Put simply, near zero interest rates have decimated assumed returns and therefore decimated real returns for many pension plans. Business Insider reports federal pensions are underfunded to the tune of $3.5 trillion. Larry Edelson of Money and Markets says state pension plans are looking at another $4 trillion in unfunded liabilities. Unfunded liabilities means how much will we have to pay out and how much don't we have unfunded. Funded liabilities would look at something like we're going to have to pay out $10 billion and we have $10 billion. Unfunded, it means we're going to have to pay out $10 billion and we don't have $10 billion. That's unfunded. If you add these two figures together, about $7.5 trillion, that's about 40% of U.S. GDP. Staggering. GDP is the money that's taken in by all the goods and services sold in the United States for a year. Zero Hedge reports the top U.S. corporate pension plans. Now, these are outside of the one that Mr. Edelson talked about and outside of the one that Zero Hedge talked about. Just the first 25 corporate pension plans, the largest, are underfunded by about a quarter of a trillion, $225 billion to be exact. This figure doesn't include hundreds of other corporations. How many other private corporations do we know besides the largest 25 that also use the same models and likely have similar shortfalls? With the stock market reaching new highs, indeed, right, we're over 19,000, and many pension plans also holding some stocks, the problem may have improved somewhat since these figures were released. But the majority of pension holdings in conservative fixed income instruments, which is the majority of what these pension plans would likely hold, they are not as subject to market movement. Stocks go up, fixed income may not move. The shortfalls will likely remain at ominous levels before the problem is resolved, with many doubting it can be resolved at all. The damage is that bad. And I would add, can you say the mother of all bailouts? Is that coming? I mean, it would be hard to imagine the government wouldn't step forward and bail out large pension plans. They're not supposed to. There's no law that says they have to. But could they? Let's look at their history of bailouts. And then you can answer your own question. I don't know. It's very interesting. And I just read, as I said, I think it was last week. I think it was in Texas. They're another large state now that has their state pension plan underfunded. If I have my state right, I'm pretty sure it's Texas. And all you'd have to do is Google up underfunded state pension plans, and you'll see probably a massive list with an amazing amount of money that's not there that they promised to pay. So what's going to happen? Again, I'll say your pension plan will pay you until they don't. And then they'll cut it back because they don't have the money. There is a pension benefit guarantee corporation that may cover some pension plans and pay partial or what have you on a pension plan that may go under and not be able to pay. But that's the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the PBGC. You can look that up on Google and read all about what that is. And, of course, we talked about the German banking conglomerate. There we go. Deutsche Bank. Of course, its stock's been cut in thirds, and its problems have not gone away. We read this article a couple of weeks ago, so I won't go over it again. But, again, is the world banking system at risk from Deutsche? This bank is not small. 100,000 employees, 71 countries. 2009, Deutsche Bank was the largest foreign exchange dealer in the world with a market share of 20% of foreign exchange. Wow. So there are rumors, at least Wikipedia says that Deutsche Bank was one of the major drivers of the collateralized debt obligation, the housing blow-up. And they created 32 trillion dollars worth of mortgage-backed security derivatives. Wow. And, of course, your taxpayer dollars were used to partially bail out some of these large corporations. In fact, AIG received $12 billion by U.S. taxpayers. And, of course, German bank Deutsche had, debts owed by AIG. So they got some money out of your bailout money. So it's reported about $70 trillion in derivatives on Deutsche Bank's books. Derivatives are large unregulated bets of which content and trigger points are known only by Deutsche and probably a few privileged others. Its collapse, if indeed happens, may have a much greater impact on financial markets than the Lehman Brothers fiasco. Remember the Lehman Brothers fiasco? That started the whole dominoes going backwards in 08, didn't it? Jim Willey in his Silver Doctor's September 17th essay said, the important thing to keep in mind about Deutsche Bank is that it won't go down alone if it goes down at all. If it fails, it will take along 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 15 other banks with it. So says Jim Willey. And TheStreet.com, well-respected site, added to the specter of a Deutsche failure when it wrote on August 25th, the 08-09 global financial crisis is nothing compared to what would happen if Deutsche Bank collapsed. So is a failure of this magnitude possible? I don't know. Will they bail them out? I don't know. They bail everybody else out. So it's rather interesting. My money's on another bailout should Deutsche be asked to ask for a life preserver. I just can't see that the central banks of the world would let Deutsche go under knowing what could happen. And so, yeah, what do you think of the Trump markets, huh? May you live in interesting times, for sure. One of the prudent strategies for investors to consider, and something we've covered on this show before, is having an exit point. Now, what is an exit point? Well, those of you who have gambled at a slot machine, most people, when they gamble, will put money into a slot machine, and if they lose a certain amount, they will say, that's it, I'm out of here. That is an exit point. I'm going to spend $200 on the slot machine, and I ain't gambling anymore. Now, the question is, do people exercise this in their large, vast sums of money that they have in their portfolios? Well, what is common in the minds of people and in many advisors is that you're down 5% and you think, and they say, you're only down 5%, no problem. And then you go down 10 and they say, well, you're only down 10%, no problem. They'll say the same thing at 15 and 20 and 25%. Well, you know, only down 20%, no problem. At some point, the story changes. Well, you're down 25%, you don't want to sell out now. You see what happens? There is never a point where you leave the slot machine. You basically keep saying, not down far enough, not down far enough, not down far enough. Well, I'm down too far. I might as well not get out. Well, you don't exercise that mindset when you gamble, do you? You don't go to the slot machine and say, well, I'm down 200. I'm down far enough, but I'm down too far to quit. So I'll go to the ATM and continue to exhaust my funds in my bank account because I'm down too far to quit. No, nobody does that. Not many people do that. Maybe gambling addicts do that. But usually we'll walk away from a slot machine, but not a lot of people won't walk away in the markets. They'll let it go down until they're not down far enough, and then they'll say they're down too far. It's a very, very tricky psychological game your mind plays with you. And indeed, many investors took losses on their stock portfolios in 08 and 09. And most would attribute those huge losses to plunging stock prices. But there are obvious and maybe not so obvious strategies that may have mitigated some of these losses, yet few investors I know utilize these. One of the most important aspects, I think nobody would argue it, is investing is not to lose money, or if you lose money, at least minimize the amount of loss. That is so important in my opinion. Minimize the loss. Don't let a 5% loss turn into a 30% loss. Obviously, if you're losing money, nobody likes to lose money, but if you're in the stock market, there is a chance of losing money. Everybody knows that. You may not be able to tolerate a loss, but you're in there to hopefully make money. But that means that there is a possibility that you may lose money. So a good investment strategy may be to say, I will lose, but I will risk the money, but I want to try to limit what I lose. And limit what I will lose may be walking away at a certain point, setting a point where you exit, you get out. You can also do that on the upside. You can make a certain amount of money and have a predisposed plan. I'm going to make 20% and then get out and walk away from the table. People do that at the poker table. I'm up 300. I'm out. I'm gone. But, of course, greed sets in investor portfolios, and you say, I want to make 20,000. I want to make 40. And everybody's guilty of that. I've been guilty of that. You know, see, there's something running and say, wow, look at that. I'm going to make a million on this stock or this investment. So having an exit point. An exit point could be a certain percentage. I'm going to lose 7% and I'm out. Or if a stock drops by 10%, I'm out of that particular stock. And so that's what we call an exit point. And you set that and you obey it. You obey it. And because if you have an exit point, you know how much you're going to lose. And that's it. You can always get back in later. Now, remember, if you sell on a stop and you get out, if the market runs again, you won't participate in the gains, right? Because you're out. So that could be a downside to getting out. But you tell me whether that sounds logical or not. Is it better to limit your losses and forego the potential gains you'll make if you sell? Well, that's each individual decision. Do I want to lose a lot, or do I want to just go for it and stay in there no matter what? This change in thought process to you're not down far enough to you're down too far, in my opinion, is a dangerous one. You may not participate if the stock runs again, and that's happened to everybody. Stock drops, you sell, and it turns and runs. But that's the nature of investing. If you can't take the thought, or you can't stomach a loss, you shouldn't be in the stock market, because you're in there for gains, which means you can't not accept the possibility of loss. Now, there's some strategies here that I've been allowed to talk about that I'm going to talk about how that is possible. But for the most part, if you're in stock market for the gains, you have to accept the possibility of loss, but you can limit how much pain usually that you can experience. Now, sometimes in a drastic market sell-off overnight, you could say, I'm going to get out of this stock at 10% loss. And overnight, the stock opens up down 20. It's happened. Flash crash a couple of years ago. And there's really no way to avoid that unless you're trading overnight, always on the button. And most people are not always on the button. So that is a possibility. And remember, you could lose gains if the stock turns and runs. In the 08-09 crisis, investors are lucky that the market stopped. Even though I saw portfolio losses 30-40%, some people I talked to, it was heartbreaking to see these people. The Fed stepped up and they did this bailout and they started bailing out everybody, and the market finally stopped its brutal sell-off. Got down to about 6,500 on the Dow. And they're lucky, because there is a point where you will sell. Statistically, we kind of know where people will sell. If you're down 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, there will be people selling on the way down. But a lot of investors won't sell until they're down 60 or 70%. And then they'll say, we got to get out with something. And then they'll sell with a massive, massive loss. And interestingly enough, that's where a lot of the smart money may start buying, because they say, okay, it's sold off far enough. So consider an exit point. Consider an exit point if you have an advisor, considering talking to them about that. Yeah, if that fits, you know, the way you think you should protect your money. And this 60 or 70% loss that we see a lot of investors, we usually call that a capitulation sell-off. It's selling at the bottom. You know, and many retail investors, the average mom and pop, you know, might see years of gains vanish in market crashes. And a lot of people did. Saw years of gains. I saw a lot of people that were in the dot-com market. Had much money in there, and they kept leveraging up like they did in housings. And then dot-com sold off, and they got wiped out. They didn't have a stop. Even if you're up, let's say you're up 80%. You could say, well, if I'm up 80% when I reach down 70%, I'm going to sell. When I say reach down, I mean, let's say you had an 80% gain. Stock market started to turn on you, and you only had a 70% gain. You could say, well, that's it. I'm going to walk away with some profits. And that's always prudent advice, at least in my opinion. That's called a trailing stop. A stop is normal. Stop loss is when you say, I'm down 10, I'm going to get out. A trailing stop is something runs on you and you make money, and then when you start to give it back, you get out. That's called a trailing stop. So establishing a sell point yourself, or making sure your advisor establishes or has a sell point strategy in place with your money. Remember, advisors have to do what you say they have to do. So if you say, I want out and I want a stop loss, you probably want to be more specific and say, look, if I drop 5%, I'm out. Or if any stock drops 10%, I'm out. And I want you to do that because it's your money, right? It's, after all, it is your money. So I want you to be careful and I want you to watch that. It's like a fire escape, man. You may not get out of the house if a candle turns over and starts the top of the bureau on fire, but you're sure as hell going to get out if the kitchen goes up in flames or your Christmas tree flames on. So I want to talk about, there are alternative strategies to traditional stock market holdings. A lot of people don't know about these, and you should know about these. Excuse me. You should know about these because they're out there. Investors normally come to the stock market to hedge against inflation, right? If there was no inflation, you could go into a bank CD and you wouldn't have to worry about it. You got your savings and, you know, the buying power will always be there. But inflation will erode The savings buying power of a CD or cash in the bank. And so most people say, I have to keep up with inflation if it takes off. We're seeing slight indications of inflation taking off. But again, certain things are going down in value as well. So, you know, who knows? But most investors agree they should keep up with inflation and living expenses. And investors often say to me they just can't get any decent returns in the bank. So that's why they're in the stock market. And the lower interest rates go, the more people go to the stock market to try to protect themselves against inflation. The stock market can be a very good way to protect against inflation because theory goes where the price of a stock goes up like the price of a Starbucks coffee. If you see massive inflation, stock prices may have a tendency to follow. It is common for portfolio balances to rise and fall somewhat in concert with the general market. That's called general market risk. But how much they move depends on what kind of assets you hold. Certain stocks move faster than the market up and down, and certain stocks move the same, and certain holdings move less. That's the term for that is a beta. A stock that moves in concert with the general market is a beta of 1. If you see a stock that has a beta of less than 1, let's say 0.65, that stock historically has moved less than the market, both up and down. So if somebody wanted to be very conservative, you would look for holdings that have lower betas, under 1. Now, you won't make as much at an up market because it's got a lower beta. But you won't lose as much, usually, if you're going to look at historical prices anyway and project forward, you won't lose as much if the stock market drops. Now, remember, betas are historical, okay? So that you cannot ever judge what a stock's going to do in the future based on what its beta is. It's just saying what it historically has done. To get a lower beta on your portfolio, less volatility, okay, you're not going to make as much in an up market, but you won't lose as much in a down market. So besides having stops in there and trailing stops, moving some positions to fixed income baskets such as debt instruments, bonds, or traditionally defensive or less volatile areas can or may, let me correct that, may help out smooth out violent moves and may provide income or payments to the portfolio, which kind of helps offset losses. If your money is making money, making an income, then the losses won't sting as much because you're also getting paid inside there. And of course, if the market goes up and your securities go up and they're also paying you, you make even more. Which areas to hold is key, really, if you want to look at volatility and how it's going to affect your portfolio. Usually in a conservative portfolio, you'll be happier when the market goes down. And you'll be not as happy if the market goes up because you won't make as much. So you trade volatility for loss potential and profit potential. Obviously, holding a large amount of cash in a portfolio would tend to smooth out ups and downs because cash doesn't move. But in up markets, you won't make as much. Some people are so paranoid, they just want to be in all cash. That's fine if that fits with your investing needs. That's okay. Or some people may have enough money. I got $10 million. Why would I be in the stock market? You know, you could have a good point there. Also, if you have cash, you have dry powder to spend if prices get lower and you decide to get in. Taking profits, like we mentioned before, on a trailing stop, that can help. Nothing can feel worse than having a huge profit in a security only to watch it go away as the security goes back down again. A successful strategy might be might attempt to limit participation in down markets, get on board with up markets. That's called market timing, having a stop loss. Get out when the markets are dropping. Now, you don't want to become day traders. That becomes difficult. But having at least some parameters for you to follow or to tell your advisor to follow is sound. Looking at losses can be indicative as to whether one is using utilized sound strategies. In down markets, were your losses significant or limited to a few percentage points? During the 08-09 crisis, did you lose 5% or did you lose 30%? In an up market, did you make 50% or only make 5%? You tell me. If I told you my portfolio, the Dow ran 1,000 points, 1,000 points, ran 2%, and I made 50, you'd say, oh, that's great. Yeah, but that means you were probably in investments that are very volatile, like leveraging up your bet. It's like betting on a number on a roulette wheel instead of betting on black and red. You bet on black and red, you've got a 98% chance of, I don't think it's 98%. I don't know. I've got a friend of mine that can tell me what the odds are. Black and red, you're not going to make as much. You're not going to lose as much. You bet on an individual number, you got one in 38 chances of making a lot of money. So in up markets, if your portfolio made a lot of money, more money than the market went up, you may be happier, but you may be also subject yourself to more risk. So gains are good, but gains can also be indicative on what the volatility is or what the risk is in your portfolio. Oh, my advisor did a great job. I doubled my money and the Dow went up 2,000 points. Well, that's good because you made money, but it also may be indicative that, hey, maybe you're in real volatile stuff and it could turn the other way around. Keeping with a sound strategy, being realistic about your gains and helping to minimize your losses is a more conservative way to look at how to invest. If you want to make 200% on your money, you know, I know people that have a gambling account. You know, I got $400,000 and they got $5,000 in a gambling account. They just gamble with it. You could get the vicarious pleasure of turning $5,000 into $20,000 without risking your $400,000. You still get the same thrill, but you don't have all your money in there. Let's say you have $10,000 in a bank account or something, and you wanted to still gamble because you've got the greed DNA in your blood. Then take $500. But see, that's the theory. You know, you're looking for a charge. You're looking for an endorphin rush. Then, you know, I wouldn't do it with your complete amount of money. So now, there are options for investors to participate in up markets without risking loss. There are. Other strategies can guarantee an investor won't outlive their money. And still other options cover concerns about estate protection, long-term care, and catastrophic illness. Okay, all those products are out there. Today, there are contracts which bind an insurance company to guarantee your principal against loss. Guarantee your principal against loss. Yet, they allow you to participate or partially participate if the market goes up. Guarantee your principal against loss, yet you participate or partially participate if the market goes up. There is another strategy which also guarantees your principal and guarantees you get income payments for life. You can never outlive your money. There are, in many of these products, tie-up periods where they only allow you to withdraw a certain amount every year or none at all. There are tie-up periods which penalize you if you withdraw your money early over a certain period of time. And you must understand all the conditions and the terms of anything you buy. But having the principal guaranteed, yet still have the potential to participate in market rallies, can be an alternative to being in stocks that can lose value, or in savings or CDs which may not keep up with inflation rate. Some of these products can be bought all the way up to age 80, but are generally considered only for younger investors. Legally, you can buy them up to age 80 on some of these products, but usually we don't look at that. You know, if you're 80, you're probably not going to want to tie your money up for 7 years or 10 years. Discussions upon what's suitable for you, of course, should be done with your advisor, or you look at your own suitability and your own situation if you do know your own investing. And there are many, many people out there that are really sharp and do their own money investing, and that is fine. You can usually put some of these products in an IRA or a non-IRA. But certain products won't have advantages in an IRA. Certain products, when you put money in a tie-up for 7 years, if you're in a non-IRA, you won't get taxed, depending on the product, for the 7 years that you're in it, because you don't get paid to the end. But if you put that in an IRA, you don't do that anyway. So there may not be the tax advantages in an IRA that you would get outside of an IRA, and you have to be made aware of those as well. CPA can easily tell you about that at your tax person. certain issues around long-term care or whatever may have tax advantages. And certain products not only guarantee your principal, but guarantee you a minimum increase. So they say, okay, you're going to put money in. We guarantee to pay you 1% of a year, every year, and unless the market rises, and then you make more money. But if the market doesn't rise or this product doesn't give you money, we still guarantee you 1% a year or whatever they guarantee you. So certain products can give you your principal guaranteed by the insurance company and also give you an interest rate every year. And then if the market goes up, you may also have participation in the rising market. You know, anytime you even look at some of these products, you have to be aware. Some of them have fees. Some of them don't. Some of them may have tax advantages. Some of them don't. Some of them have, you know, many of them, I think all of them are regulated by some state laws and federal laws. So you have to make sure that you sit down and you understand every little hook and gotcha in there. That's very, very important that you understand exactly it is what you're buying. Many investors don't know there are products like this out there. The obvious advantage to some of these is that there's downside risk, none, zero, yet upside risk is potentially there. There's so many variations of these things. Every one is different, and one of them may meet with your situation. Mixing one of these products in with traditional stock holdings and fixed income may be a way to obtain more, you know, better sleep at night or less volatility in your account. If you have 30% in one of these products that guarantee your principal yet participate in an upside market or partially participate, that part of the portfolio won't go down in value. So that would smooth out the volatility rather than being all in stocks. Some investors can't tolerate red numbers. I see it all the time. I'm in the stock market. I know I can lose money. The stock account drops 1.5% and they get worried. Well, this may be an instance one of these products may be better suited for you. You may not triple your money, but at least you're not going to, you know, get upset and lose sleep. As with every investment, of course, the standard warning, consult with your investment professional before making any investment decisions and read the prospectus and understand the terms. Every single term you must understand before making a decision. Okay? That's very important. But there are ways. There are ways that you can mitigate some of your worries and some of the risk of portfolios, and some of these you just may not be aware of. My name's Wart Mark. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We'll be right back. What else can I say, right? Yeah, so the markets are sitting around still 19,188 today, up 64. And, you know, I've been watching financial stocks. Boy, oh boy, they really ran, you know. And there's a little voice in my head. There's two voices, a lot of voices in my head, but there's two of them that when I look at financial stocks in the last couple of days, you know, I look at them and I say, wow, look at them run. They're going to 100. And then another voice in my head says, Mark, don't chase a running market. You know, I think Bank of America went from 14 to 21 or something. I don't know what. And I went, wow, they're going to the moon. But, you know, and then the other voice says, you've been burned doing that before, you know, chasing stocks. Another thing people do. I do differently. Let other people average down. How many of you have done that? You see a stock fall. And you say, okay, it's cheaper. I'll buy more shares at a lower price and average my price down. So you bought a stock at 10. It falls to 5. And you double up, which means your average price is halfway in the middle, 750. And your theory is, well, when it goes up, I'll make my money back by the time it gets to 7.5 instead of having to go to 10 again. Well, that's called averaging down. It is a common strategy people use. I mean, generally, I don't use it. I don't use averaging down. And I don't do it in portfolios, and I don't do it in my own portfolio. I don't average down because this is the way I look at it. Usually when something is falling, there is a reason. And it could be known, and it could be unknown. But I look at it like this. If you have a dress in your clothing store that you have to mark down to sell it, what does that tell you? Now, you have a dress in your clothing store and it's not selling, so you mark it down. Now, do you buy more at a lower price? No. Why? It's because it's not selling, right? So instead, we have a strategy that's averaging up. In other words, if it's running, then we may add more, but put a trailing stop in. So if we add more, it does raise our average cost, but we have more shares. So if it continues to run, we make even more. And it's at that particular moment, it's rising. It shows showing that it's favored. Now, it could turn, and then we double our losses, right? If we double the position, our losses would get greater. But it's just a mindset or an opinion. Do you buy more of something that people are selling and out of favor, or do you buy more of something that's becoming in favor? Now, the caveat here is this is not a strategy that I'm recommending to you because it's a belief. You know, it's an opinion. And both strategies can make you money and both can lose you money. But it's just the difference of the way I think versus what other thinks. Okay, well, we're running out of time. It's been my pleasure today. This has been show 242 of Money Matters. My name is Mark Cunabrini. I want to thank you for listening to me today. And keep in mind, remember, very important, that opinions in this show, should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I, Mark Cunabrini, am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge. This station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Money Matters has always been about money, as money does matter, and the matters of money affect us all in some way or another. I hope it's affecting you in a positive way. God bless. Thanks for joining me today.